through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have Joseph Chilton Pierce, author known to many of you for his works Crack in the Cosmic Egg, the national bestseller The Magical Child, Rediscovering Nature's Plan for Our Children, Evolution's End, and most recently, The Biology of Transcendence. For over 25 years, Joe has been acclaimed and featured internationally in his lectures on human development and the changing needs of children. So, Joseph Chilton Pierce, it's really a great delight to have you here in the studio.
Well, thank you, Duncan.
I think it might be very interesting to our audience to begin our dialogue here by perhaps reviewing very briefly the evolution of your own thinking and research, beginning with, over 25 years ago, your book, Crack in the Cosmic Egg, and then proceeding through The Magical Child, and a decade ago, Evolution's End. And we might then talk about the book, The Biology of Transcendence.
Well, I the other day pulled out my book, The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, and started looking at it because a publisher is going to bring it out for another edition. It was in print for 28 years, and so he's bringing it out again. I hadn't looked at the book in many a year, and I was really astonished to find that nearly everything I've been saying ever since is found in that book. I was kind of depressed because I thought, well, if I understood this much way back then, why haven't I acted it out a little bit better on the general scene? But The Magical Child, of course, came a number of years later, dealing specifically with children, and then Evolution's End, dealing with some of the real crises that we're facing with our children in this day and time. And my new book, The Biology of Transcendence, boils it all down to the bioculturalism, as it's called, the effect of culture on our biological system, and the way our biological system then affects culture in turn.
And at one point, Joe, you mentioned a phrase that culture is the enemy of biology. And so let's talk about that theme of how culture actually, instead of nourishing, actually can impede the evolutionary spiral of human consciousness.
Well, I will say that in my short 76 years, I've heard one big theme over and over all my life, and that is reform. Everything has been in a process of reformation. We have to go down and clean up the mess in Washington. We must clean up the mess in the state capitol. We must reform our schools. We must reform medicine. We must reform this. Everything in a constant state of reformation. Culture survives only by our attempts to improve it. And it preserves itself or perpetuates itself by convincing us that we must improve culture at all cost. And the truth of the matter is culture cannot be improved, and it should never be sustained, but it's sustained by our attempts to make it work right. And every facet of contemporary life, leaving nothing out at all, every facet of life is simply an adjunct of culture. And culture is the enemy of the true biological nature of the human being.
At one point in our conversation earlier, you defined culture as a body of knowledge concerning physical survival in a hostile world based on fear, so that culture, in a sense, is a survival mechanism that's passed on by belief systems from generation to generation, and it is often then at odds with the transcending adaptive spiral of human consciousness, which is literally hardwired, if we will, into our biology. So perhaps we could ask you to comment on that.
Well, I know it's hardwired in, but you have to define your term transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm basing my book and the definition of transcendence on the dictionary, which says simply, transcendence is the ability to rise above and go beyond limitation and constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Our inability to rise beyond and go beyond our current limitation and constraint leads us to all of our violence. We have in this life a choice between two things, either transcendence or violence, and there's nothing much in between.
Mm-hmm.
Culture depends on violence. Culture breeds violence, and culture thrives on violence. Gil Bailey, you might be familiar with Gil Bailey, who wrote a book called Violence Unveiled, Culture at the Humanity at the Crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
He was a follower of René Girard, the great French philosopher, who did his life study on the effect of culture and the way culture preserves itself through violence. And, of course, all this is very anarchy. It's anarchistic. It's anti-cultural. To be anti-cultural is to be virtually anti to every single aspect of what we think of as civilization. But all of my books from the beginning on have really been dealing with culture, and I wasn't aware of it until the past few years, and that our natural biological system is designed to constantly evolve and rise above the limitations and constraints of our current state. Blocking this, you have only one reaction in the human being, and that is violence. So we either transcend or we start imploding and destroying ourselves.
And it's such a fascinating perspective, because what it does is give us a sense of how evolution proceeds. I'm thinking now of a book called Earth Household, published over 30 years ago by Gary Snyder, the American poet. And in a series of essays on what is happening to our larger ecological environment and its interface with human culture, he referred to the civilization establishment, you know, capital C civilization, capital E establishment. And what's being revealed, I think, in our dialogue here and in your work is that culture or civilization is always one step behind. It's consolidating that evolutionary step that has already been made and then trying to make a fortress or a home out of it to preserve some kind of stability or security against the inbuilt
anywhere from 60 to 65% of the cells of the heart are actually neural cells, just as you find in the brain. They gather in ganglia rather than the larger fields of the brain, but essentially in the same function, which the John and Beatrice Lacy researched for 30 years under the auspices of the National Institutes of Health and came up with this direct, unmediated neural connection, direct pipeline between the heart and the brain, the fact that there's an ongoing 24-hour-a-day dialogue between the heart and the brain. The three phases of the heartbeat each creates its own initial part of this field effect that surrounds the body, and the first one is very short, but the next one is about 3 feet out, and it's very powerful. They find that they can take a perfectly clear EKG, or electrocardiogram, 3 feet away from the body. You don't have to touch the body. And then, of course, it goes on out 12 to 15 feet away at least. That's easily detectable, and we know now that it goes even further, and all these fields interact one with another. But the critical part for me is the fact that the field that extends out about 3 feet beyond the body is a very powerful field. And you get two of those fields next to each other, and they're going to interact, which gets into the whole issue of mother-child relationships, because that field effect and the overlapping of the field effect created by the heart, each individual heart, is is where a great deal of very important information lies. We know, for instance, in the new research that's just come out recently, that the mother's emotional state, which translates directly as what the heart frequency is doing in that mother, determines the shape, character, nature, and quality of the growth of the brain, its neural cells, its capacities in utero. Now comes Alan Shore's work showing that the mother's emotional state and the coherency or incoherency of her heart profoundly affects the infant in the state after birth, particularly the first 9 months, and that her coherent heart frequency or realm of influence, which we would refer to as her emotional state, determines whether or not the latest evolutionary addition of the brain, the prefrontal lobes, actually grow or not. That is, the cellular structure, whether the cellular structure is fully developed or not in that infant, depends on the mother's own emotional state, which means the state of her heart. Is it coherent or incoherent to begin with? When the infant is separated from the mother's heart, you have an incoherent frequency. So there can't be entrainment until the infant's heart is brought back into coherency. What brings it back into coherency is its immediate adjacent relationship to the mother's heart. And so her heart lifts the infant's heart out of its incoherent mode into a coherent mode, and then they go into entrainment. When you speak of entrainment of the heart, you're speaking of a very precise, measurable, simply a scientific fact, that the amplitude and the Hertz value of the heart frequencies is coherent. And if that is, then the infant brought into that frame of work will very quickly reflect that coherence. And then you find that they go into exactly the same type of frequency rhythms, which means they entrain. You could say the waveforms match. So there's no dissonance. When waveforms don't match, we speak of dissonance. If you're listening to a piece of music and all the waveforms are harmonic, then we hear harmony. And if they should suddenly someone go haywire, we hear dissonance. And the same thing with the entrainment between the mother's heart and the infant's heart. Now, this brings about a whole raft of other things. We find that if the infant's heart and the mother's heart are entrained, the brain structures go into entrainment as well. Those frequencies go into entrainment. Now, that entrained state keeps everything coherent and in perfect balance. And that is what we refer to as bonding between mother and infant. Later on, we find this bonding extending out, this ability to entrain with your environment. And the child entrains with their family. And there's harmony in that family because they're all on essentially the same frequency. Failing the initial bond with the mother, all subsequent bonding is not only put at risk, but it's very difficult to bring about. And the failure of a child to bond socially and become an active member of the society is not the child's moral, ethical failure. It's the failure of having established that bond in the beginning, on which the later social bonds must be built. And the Harvard study showed clearly that one reflected this throughout life, both in one's health and ability to interact socially with other people. Alan Shore spends a great deal of time and 2,300 research citations to show how the first 18 months of life determine all subsequent moves of intelligence, capacities to relate for the rest of one's life. Why? Because those neural structures for that have to grow in the first 18 months of life, and they grow according to the experience the child is given on an emotional level. And the most interesting thing about Shore's work is he spends the first half of the book on the first 18 months of life, and then he gets into the pathologies that he finds in teenagers and the adult. And he traces all the pathologies in the teenagers and the adults back to the failure of the appropriate emotional state given the child in the first 18 months of life. So there we go. Antonio Damasio, one of our brilliant neuroscientists, pointed out that no matter how brilliant you might have a neocortical structure, the human brain up on top, what we think of as our intellectual intellectual creative brain, that it is critically dependent on the emotional cognitive system, that the high human brain is limited by the limitations of the emotional cognitive brain. Our cognition itself is limited by the emotional system. So if you want to develop higher levels of intelligence in a child, you must first of all have a thoroughly developed emotional cognitive system in that child, or you have no foundation to move on into the higher levels of human intelligence. And it's on this very basis that our whole educational system has been falling apart. Our whole social system is falling apart. Our family systems are falling apart because they're, you might say, higher evolutionary intelligence is involved, and we're failing to put in that fundamental foundation of the emotional security, the safe space, the bonding of that infant with its mother. From conception on, that bond must be made.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
Have you ever had a dream, Leo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream?
every mammal on this planet instinctively develops a natural equilibrium with the surrounding environment, but you humans do not. You move to an area and you multiply. Multiply until every natural resource is consumed. The only way you can survive is to spread to another area. There is another organism on this planet that follows the same pattern. Do you know what it is? A virus.
This idea that fundamentally we are warlike, fundamentally we are hostile, fundamentally we are violent, that is the idea promoted by culture, and it's what keeps culture going. And it's the greatest lie ever told.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
Have you ever had a dream, Leo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were able to wake from that dream?
Every mammal on this planet instinctively develops a natural equilibrium with the surrounding environment, but you humans do not. You move to an area and you multiply. You multiply until every natural resource is consumed. The only way you can survive is to spread to another area. There is another organism on this planet that follows the same pattern. Do you know what it is? A virus.
This idea that fundamentally we are warlike, fundamentally we are hostile, fundamentally we are violent, that is the idea promoted by culture, and it's what keeps culture going. And it's the greatest lie ever told.
Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded. And we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace. Thank you very much. You've been great. I hope you enjoyed it.
We'll be right back.
biology. The new biologists are really quite magnificent. My main interest has, in the last few years, centered around violence, and I've gotten kind of hipped on the subject. I'm disturbed over the violence in the world as a whole, and it does not seem to be getting better. It seems to be getting worse. I've spent about 4 years working on a book that I doubt very much I will ever finish. I don't buy green bananas any longer. And seriously, this book, as I said, I've worked on it about 4 years, and I can't even get anybody to read it. It's on the biology of transcendence, and I've looked at the evolutionary process to show that it's a transcendent process right from the very beginning, that it all moves toward transcendence. If you look up the dictionary, it gives the definition of transcendence as the ability to rise and go beyond limitation. Isn't that neat? That's all it is. Very simple. And if you look into the biology of the human brain, and where it came from, you'll find it's simply a series of rising and going beyond its own limitations. The issue about our violence is that we are, thank you, we're biologically designed for transcendence, and either that is developed in us or violence is the only possible alternative. That is, we're faced with transcendence or violence, and there's really no in-between. And the more our transcendent structure within us gets impaired, the more violent we become. And that's why I really support Waldorf education at every chance I possibly can, because if there is one single force left in the world that could lead us out of violence, it's Waldorf education. And I must say, I've had a lot of grandchildren in Waldorf school, and one daughter. I have a 49-year-old daughter and a 19-year-old daughter. Not many of you can brag about that. I wanted to start off with talking about the work of Paul MacLean. Most people have heard me talk about Paul MacLean for a long time. He was, for 40-some years, head of the whole neuroscience at the National Institutes of Health, one of the biggest research groups in the world, and he's one of the great neuroscientists of all times. He was the first one to ever come up with the fact that these three divisions of our brain, what they originally called a hindbrain and a forebrain, hindbrain the old brain, and the forebrain being the mixture of the old mammalian brain and the new mammalian brain, or our brain, human brain. And he was the one who pointed out that these three different major areas of the brain are the whole evolution of brains since the beginning of, practically the beginning of life. That we embrace in our skull all development in brains throughout history. We've got them all there. And if you want to understand what makes your neighbor so cantankerous, it's this old reptilian brain here. Or what makes your boss, you know, such a carnivore or something. That is the issue, is the old reptilian brain. Now, MacLean spent 40-some years studying these brains for the kinds of behavior genetically encoded in them. And so it was on the brain and the evolutionary development of brain and behavior that he spent most of his life. And with that as a little preview here, I want to get into what I consider the most exciting research, certainly in the past 10 years and maybe in the past 50, that just came out in 1997, 98, somewhere along there, about the forebrain and the hindbrain. Now, let me mention again now that the forebrain are the two latest evolutionary additions of our brain, the old mammalian brain, what we call our emotional brain, and this one up on top called the neocortex of the new brain, or the human brain. And evolution has moved from this very primitive sensory motor structure of the reptilian brain, adding more and more over really a total of several hundred million years. and finally has given us this huge thing called the human brain. But it all rests on this very ancient sensory motor hindbrain. The hindbrain is the one that defends us. It's the one that's going to rear up and bite you if you come close to it and that sort of thing. And the forebrain is, of course, our reflective, intellectual, verbal, creative brain. So you've got this reflexive, fast, lightning fast, quick survival brain, defensive and touchy, that we call the hindbrain, and this reflective, more intelligent, vastly more intelligent, forebrain. Now with that, we got into some research that just came out a short time back. Any pregnant mammal, human or anything else, that is in a tense, anxiety-ridden, hostile, competitive environment will give birth to an infant with an enlarged hindbrain, a larger body, larger musculature, and a sharply reduced forebrain. Okay? Any mother who is in a safe, protective, loving, nurturing environment will give birth to an infant with an enlarged forebrain and a sharply reduced hindbrain. Okay? And a smaller body. Now, research shows, in fact, that if her conditions change in the middle of pregnancy from a hostile environment to a loving, nurturing one, the actual shape and change of the brain changes in utero accordingly. If she starts off with everything lovey-dovey and feeling that everything is okay and suddenly things very, very rocky, immediately a change takes place in the growth of that brain system. And it's the most Darwinian, sensible, practical thing nature could do. She tries to prepare the infant for what? The kind of environment that her mother is sensing that he's going to have to take his place in. Is that making sense? Yeah? But now let's look at the part of the brain that is particularly involved in this. Is this intellectual forebrain here. Now, if a person is brought into the world with a reduced-sized forebrain and a great big hindbrain and a larger body, what are they going to be? They're going to be equipped for a hostile environment. And we find a strange thing in the studies in bioculturalism, such as Antonio De Nicolas and Maria Colavito at the State University of New York, I've been working on for a long time, bioculture. The fact that our culture profoundly affects our biology and our biology profoundly affects our culture. They are dynamic back and forth. And so if you start getting a large number of mothers who are undergoing a lot of tension and hostility and who don't feel safe and are worried about things in pregnancy, what's happening? She's going to be giving birth, of course, to children that are equipped for that kind of environment. And what will happen? Inevitably, they create the kind of environment they're equipped for. Now, the more that environment is created, that they're used to, then what is going to happen? Then the greater the overall level of the whole anxiety level and so on and so forth, and the level of that culture will increase, and as a result, that tendency will then grow and grow and grow. Is that making any sense? It makes too much sense to me. I almost wish I'd never heard of all that. Now, this is an exciting time in history because we've learned more about the development of the brain and its behavior than any time in history, and even in the last 10 years. And it's extraordinarily exciting to think of what we could really do for our children with all the knowledge we have. At the same time, things are happening which are serious, very serious, for the survival of the species itself. In 1975, German professors at Tübingen
began to realize that the students they were working with weren't responding as students had in the past. And every year it became more and more severe. They simply were not able to comprehend, they weren't able to retain their information, and they were just different. And so with the German Psychological Institute, they set up a 20-year project interviewing something over 4,000 people every year. And these were young people, young adults, 18 to 20 is what I understand they were, not children, but young adults. And their findings, they published about 1975. What they found out, there was a 1% reduction of the overall sensory system's ability to bring in information from its environment per year. And they found a clear 20% difference in the sensory intake, the ability to bring in sensory information, in the young people of 1995 than they had in 1975. And let me backtrack for a minute with the work of Marcia McCulloch. She got disturbed about what was happening to children, and in the mid-1980s, took a batch of the tests out of Princeton and other places in their child development, some of the Yale studies and all, for testing children's ability to respond to external information, that is, just their environment right around them. Their sense of taste, touch, smell, feel, hearing, listening, remembering, responding, general cognition. And she went down to South America in some of the jungle areas and tested the jungle children. And then she went to Guatemala and tested some of these very, very, the lowest standards of living in the world, you know, the grass shacks and all that. And went to Africa and tested the children in many very pre-literate African societies. Then she started testing both children in America and on over in Europe. She found that our children in America operated at 25 to 30% less ability to bring in sensory information and respond to it than did the children in these grass shacks and so forth and so on. Now, this is a great shock. We think, well, our children have had the highest standard of living and all these great advantages. Why should children from pre-literate societies be miles ahead in that? The average person 20 years ago could distinguish over 300 different shades of a single color. You know, no matter how subtle it became, you could still recognize, well, red or a form of red and so on. This had reduced to 130 by 1995. Now, that's a very sharp cut back in the ability of the eyes to see and so on and so forth. And the same thing happened with all the other senses. Drastic reductions in the sensitiveness to one's own direct environment. Some of their conclusions, for instance, was that these young people had to have such a high intensity of input to get past the reticular activating system of the brain, I'll show you a picture of one in a minute, that anything less than a high intense input of sensory information simply wasn't registered. They said, for instance, put into a calm, pastoral, wood-like setting, let's say, or park-like setting, the average young people now got very nervous. They got anxiety-ridden and fidgety. Why? Because their brain wasn't receiving enough sensory information really to keep it going. They were suffering sensory deprivation in anything like an ordinary setting. They went on. Now, there was this Dr. Harold Rao, I remember at Tübingen University, who said that because of the difference of the actual shape and nature and character of the brains of these people over a 20-year shift, that really we were dealing with students whose brains bore very little relationship to what they had been 20 years ago. Now, this is in Germany, so we can always bring the sigh of relief and say, well, that's in Germany. But the issue was that the brains were doing what? Changing dramatically according to the nature of the environment. Now, when you get into the reticular formation, we could give you a picture of it right quick, but it's in the old brain. It's in the old brain system way down here, or let's just say the reptilian brain. That's in red. That's easy to see. And what it is a, we can call it a gateway that brings all the sensory information from the body and all the rest of the head and everything else, and kind of synthesizes, brings it all together and sends it up for processing to the higher brain centers. What has happened is that dating mechanism has gotten higher and higher and higher every year, so it took more and more input of a heavier nature to register, to get past the gate as it went up. The threshold got higher. From what? Inappropriate stimuli from the first moment of birth on that did not match the stimuli needed for the two ancient brain structures called what? The reptilian brain and the old mammalian brain. The reptilian brain, of course, being also the spinal cord and really the whole neural system of the body. That's really what the reptilian brain is. And that the information coming in was not appropriate for the development of these two ancient brains, our sensory motor and our emotional brain, on which the high intellectual brain could function, you see. Inappropriate information. And so what was happening? Well, these weren't developing appropriately at all, and because the stimuli given them was so unnatural and of such a far greater intensity than these two brain structures were designed to handle over 100 million years of development, information they just weren't able to handle at all. And so what happens? It says the brain simply breaks down in its adaptive ability and begins to grow and function according to try to survive in a totally unnatural situation. Now, what's the next result of this is that the great intellectual creative brain up on top rests on and depends exclusively on the development of the two animal brains, as we call it. And so the two animal brains aren't developing appropriately at all because they're not receiving appropriate nurturing or stimuli. And as a result, the higher brain can't develop at all as it should. Both are maladapting to the kind of situation that children are exposed to. Now, this does have some relevance to what's happening to us in this country. And I want to just mention that here, because this is really a pretty serious situation. Now, Alan Shore is a medical guy down at the medical school at University of California in Los Angeles, and he spent 12 years on a single book, one of the most extraordinary single episodes we've ever had in child development. Alan Shore, I just bow down and bay at the moon when you mention his name. He's a very great man. He spent this entire time on the period of development from the 11th month through the 18th month after birth. And he said that during that time, that the shape of the brain was determined almost entirely by the emotional state of the mother-child relationship. Now, this follows on, or precedes, it came before the discovery that the brain developing in utero depends almost exclusively on what? Nature and character of the mother's emotional state. Now, here we have the fact that the brain shapes according to the environment that the mother thinks she's in utero, and then after that, the shape of the brain is determined in its actual growth by the kind of emotional state set up between the mother and the infant. Now, that gets us up to the three different levels of the brain again, and I have to add a fourth. Actually, the most exciting single thing, and the thing I'm going to be talking about quite a bit tonight, and some of you have heard me yak about this before, is that this high brain up here has, from this point right here, you've got the cerebral cortex here, and then you've got this area here right behind the eyes. It's the largest single section of the whole brain, which is called the prefrontal lobes. Now, the major part of these three brains Reptilian formed over hundreds of millions of years, very, very ancient, very powerful, very strong, sensory motor, survival, defensive brain. The old mammalian brain, many millions of years old, very strong, very powerful brain for relating to. And then the new intellectual verbal brain that makes the human situation. But then about 40,000 years ago, and we're not sure of that date, and there's a lot of controversy about it, but it looks like about 40,000 years ago, nature added another one, and it's called the prefrontal lobes. And Shore found out that the majority of the prefrontal lobe doesn't develop in the utero. The actual cellular growth of this huge prefrontal lobe is determined by the emotional nurturing the child receives in the first year of life. And most children get most of their emotional nurturing in the first year of life. Then comes this critical thing of the prefrontal lobes, which is this part right up behind the eyes, and its connections with the old mammalian brain, which is our emotional brain. I think of Patricia Goldman Rakic, one of our really top-notch neuroscientists, saying the job of these prefrontal lobes seems to be to monitor, moderate, modulate, and actually govern the behavior of all the rest of the brain, including the majority of the neocortex, the new brain. The prefrontal seem to be the governor of the whole show. And when does that really grow? Immediately after birth, in coordination with the mother's emotional nurturing. And the more the nurturing, the more the prefrontal lobes, the more the ability to moderate and modulate the activity in all the rest of the brain. Following? Now, right before the first year of life, before their first birthday, okay, before they're getting ready to rear up on the hind legs and charge out to become the terrible two, there's a huge growth spurt, not only in the prefrontal lobes, but particularly in what they call the orbitofrontal loop, which is one of the most critical parts of their whole life. It's where this newest brain in evolutionary history, added only 40,000 years ago, brand new, and we've never really learned to use it yet, and its connections with the emotional brain that has to do with all of our capacity to relate to each other. Because the emotional brain is the one that handles all of our loves, hates, likes, dislikes, and ability to relate to each other. And to learn, remember, and all that. That's the old mammalian brain that we share with all mammals. And its connection with the prefrontal is it starts after the first year of life. Why does it have to wait until then? Because we've got to wait until the prefrontals have grown enough. This grows in utero. This grows after utero, the prefrontal lobes. And so now, there's this growth spurt where they connect together in this tremendously critical part, and it's determined almost exclusively by the treatment the child receives from its caretaker. We have to shift from mother here to caretaker for 80% of our children, because they don't have really mothers. They have caretakers now, as you know most of them do. Now, what Shore did, and he found that all of these are what he calls experience-dependent neural structures. By experience-depending, it means the kind of environment the child is in, that neural structure will be maintained or not. And he found that this great growth spurt that takes place in the 11th month, getting ready for that 12th month change over from our crawling around on our belly and our mammalian over to the first real step into being a full human, getting up on their hind legs, that growth spurt is almost completely deconstructed for the majority of children in the next 6 to 7 months when they hit what's called socializing the child. Okay? What does it mean by socializing the child? Making him behave so he won't embarrass us in society. That's all it is. Okay. And Shore finds that in the average American household, this little child finally getting up on their hind legs to charge out and do what nature encodes within them as their strongest, their second strongest drive, which is to explore every single item in the world that they don't know, every new item, with their full sensory system and build what Piaget calls a structure of knowledge of it. That is the